It is time for us to be joined by David on the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. David is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. David also has his own website, themediabeat.us, and we are lucky to have him join us every Friday morning here on Robin Hood Radio. Good morning, David.
Well, hello. I'm happy to be joining you from Florida this week instead of, for a change, the media capital of the world, New York City. And of course, as ever, I'm glad to be talking with the ever incisive Marshall Miles.
Well,
I'm actually outdoors in Florida. I'm in a nature reserve about which I will tell you much more another time when I've got all my ducks in a row, if you pardon the phrase. I'm surrounded by animal life, and it's a place which is a story in itself, which I will tell you some other time. But I'm here at the moment just to do the media beat with you. Oh, I think that's a blue heron out there, and you might be able to hear the call. Can you?
Yes, I can hear that, absolutely.
I'm not sure if it's a blue heron, certainly a heron of some kind. So we've been reminded, I guess, of an old adage in the media world. Here I am in the southeastern extremity of the United States, and you know, I have to say it's known in media circles for its extremes. Florida equals extremes, it seems, for many journalists. There's a serious aspect to it, which I realized as soon as I arrived. After this last week, when the country as a whole has been shocked and is still horrified at a 15-year-old and his parents being charged with a fatal shooting in Oxford, Michigan. Now this week here in Clearwater, Florida, we're provided with the horrific story of a 3-year-old shooting himself with a gun that was in his parents' house. Over the past few months, as I looked into it, there have been several such cases of injured children in homes where there were guns, involving a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, a 12-year-old. This lesson keeps being pounded into us, and yet, as we know, very little changes on that front. But in terms of extremes, I mean, there was also a story here in the waters off the Florida Keys. There was an extraordinary report of a very rare find floating in the water off the Keys. It was this sizable package lost by someone, $1 million worth of smuggled cocaine. So there you have, in a little snapshot, something of Florida life. If you want drama in your stories, it seems, you should come to Florida. And of course, the political climate, the whole country knows about this. The Republican governor, Rick DeSantis, considered by local and national media to be a contender for the United States presidency in 2024, if that is doesn't run. DeSantis practices his own form of extremism, I guess you might say. Extreme anti-mandate measures for COVID. State laws now, not just his own executive edicts. He's managed to ban, with the support of the legislature, he's managed to ban mandates for vaccination and for mask wearing. He's also made it very clear, even though we now have the disturbing new COVID variant, Omicron, it will make no difference to his stance. In fact, he's used the Omicron appearance to do guess what? turn it into an opportunity to attack the media. The media, who are of course concerned about his evident recklessness in leadership by banning mandates for masks and mandates for vaccines, which other leaders in different parts of the country are embracing, both governmental leaders and business bosses too. He said many times, and I want to quote him here because it's such a clear demonstration of the I'm not sure I'm using it. The word extremity, extremism, perhaps. Here's what he said about whether he was going to moderate his position in view of the risks from Omicron. He said, "We're not in Florida going to allow any media-driven hysteria." Media-driven hysteria, he says, to do anything to infringe people's individual freedoms when it comes to any type of COVID variants. So that's the man in charge down here.
Well, and it is so obvious how he's setting himself up that if Donald Trump, if something happens where Donald Trump can't run for the presidency, he would be the perfect fit to take over if that's the case.
That's certainly what he thinks. Yeah.
All right. Well,
he's supported too by a legislature that's to the tune of 2-1 Republican to Democrat in Florida. So that's a executive leader. In the executive branch of the government is supported, almost unchallenged. Mind you, it doesn't prevent the Democratic leadership here trying desperately for media attention in their critiques of DeSantis, the co-leader of minority in the state House of Representatives, accused the governor of. These policies of DeSantis effectively, the words were, it's fitting Floridians, get my mouth around that, fitting Floridians with concrete shoes with his measures to banish restrictions. It's redolent phrasing, isn't it? Headline writers might find it hard to, well, they have in Florida found it hard to resist. You get a sense of a political climate there when phrases like that are bandied around with all their mafiosi connotations.
All right. Well, let's get away from DeSantis for a while, and let's bring in our fanfare for some good media news.
Sure, do that.
All right, hang on a second here. We got to get this set up here and make sure I've got it all lined up. Hang on.
Full breath for the fanfare.
Here we go.
Well played, Marshall. You have strong lungs. That's great. The fanfare this week has to go in very general terms for, I think, just an instance of very good media practice overall. Nothing specific, no specific story to single out here. But I just want to point out that while I'm here, that Florida is home to one of the country's best regional newspapers. Let's hear it for the Miami Herald. The Herald more than holds its own with the other regional papers of note, the Boston Globe, the Chicago Tribune, the LA Times. They're all good papers, but here in Florida, Miami takes the lead, and really deservedly so. It, as well as covering its own immediate bailiwick, and that, of course, includes Governor DeSantis, of course. But also recently the specific and terrible story of the Surfside condo building collapse, which they covered extremely well, and you and I have talked about that while it was going on, and the tremendous work by one particular reporter, Julie K. Brown, who in a way owns the entire Jeffrey Epstein story of child sex abuse ever since several years ago. She doggedly first brought it into the open, despite all the legal attempts being made to minimize it and cover it up. But the other thing to say about the Miami Herald is that we've come to rely upon it, really, for some of the best coverage of Guantanamo, including for instance, the latest legal developments there, coverage of Haiti as well. Some of the best coverage that any American media have done on Haiti. And the rest of the Caribbean too, and many Latin American countries. They're just a staple, reliable source of good quality journalism, and I just wanted to note them while I was here.
Let's come back into the United States, and we'll go to Donald Trump because so now one court has now said that Donald Trump can't keep those documents away from the investigators that want to look at it. They will give him a chance to reply to their ruling, but they ruled in favor of the January 6th committee being able to get those documents.
Sure, and the January 6th committee of the House is determined to get those documents. There will be, no doubt, an appeal. And it will be interesting if it does go to appeal, because, of course, going as far as the Supreme Court is something that Trump would clearly like. After all, the bench of the Supreme Court now has an unassailable conservative majority, mainly due to the fact that right-wing, if I can use that blunt term, justices were appointed by Trump himself. So we'll see how that goes. But the interesting thing is that the legal judgment's being recorded as this struggle continues to get papers and indeed staff members for Trump and indeed his informal advisors also to be subpoenaed by the committee. All the judgments that are found as this struggle continues, it builds up a kind of momentum, showing if only this, and this in itself is enough in its political value, if you like, to show that Trump clearly feels and the people around him doing his bidding clearly feel there is something to hide. I mean, their basic argument, of course, is that it's all about the privacy of a chief executive to be able to discuss matters of sensitivity with his own advisors without it being exposed to public view, which, of course, is a reasonable enough argument for governments all over the world. But the pitch with which it is being fought suggests that there's a lot more here that Trump and Co., as it were, Trump Inc., it's sometimes called, that coterie of people around him, is clear evidence, or at least suggestive evidence, that there have been conversations that they simply don't want the American public to know about, whatever involvement there may have been by Trump himself and his staff members and his informal advisors in that appalling incursion into the Capitol on January the 6th.
And at the same time, that's going on in New York State now. There is a date set for Donald Trump to possibly testify in the civil case against the Trump Company.
Sure, and that has interesting ramifications for the entire governance of my home state of New York. The Attorney General, Letitia James, has been weighing, not surprisingly, a run for the governorship herself. She managed, with some of her investigations, aside from the Trump investigation, she led an investigation into the governor, ex-governor now, Andrew Cuomo. Very successfully, in the sense that there was no prosecution, but he certainly felt that he was in a position when he had to resign. But his successor is now firmly in place. And although Letitia James did announce a run for the governorship, she decided only yesterday that she was going to, quote-unquote, suspend her campaign for the governorship. And one of the main reasons she gave, and we ought to believe this, is that she has some important legal business to conduct still as the Attorney General. She wants to stay on as Attorney General to finish these important cases. And, of course, the most important of that is her opportunity to depose, and I suspect she'll want to do it herself in person, depose the former President of the United States, Donald J. Trump.
Another story that broke overnight and late yesterday was that the United States did win its bid to extradite Julian Assange back to the United States with some bitter disagreement with other people around the world.
Sure, sure. Julian Assange, who is responsible for massive leaks. The classic argument is a fourth, of course. This is, for many people, a matter of principle about the freedom of the press. It's a sticky one because Julian Assange is not the best standard bearer for a matter of great principle like the freedom of the press. My own private opinions are of no particular relevance here, but the court case in Britain showed the currents for and against this extradition. And this is another matter, almost a mirror image in a slightly skewed way of the Trump investigation, in that this will go to appeal. And it'll be interesting to see what the British higher appeal courts say about that. It may even go to the British Supreme Court, which, by the way, is a fairly recent invention of the Blair government's period in office, Tony Blair. We never had quite the same kind of Supreme Court. There was a bench formed of what is known as the Law Lords, members of the House of Lords who happened to be judges. But this is that we now have much more formally and constitutionally prescribed Supreme Court in Britain, and that now will be considering the Julian Assange affair. So the story is not over yet, and it'll be very interesting to see how the British react, the British top judges react to this case. The idea of the freedom of the press is enshrined in constitution in the United States, but Britain, with its infamous unwritten constitution, is a lot more vague about these issues. So we need to watch that rather carefully, I think.
Another story of note, immigration have been in the headlines in Mexico. 100 people injured, 54 killed inside a tractor-trailer truck that crashed, bringing Central American migrants potentially into Mexico and then potentially into the United States. This is just one of those disaster stories that was bound to happen with the way migrants are focused on and pay big money to try to get out of their country and into other countries.
Sure, the whole industry of people trafficking gives rise every now and again, more and more often it seems, whether it's by water or by land, to horrible events with you know exposing the conditions in which people are prepared to find their way, they hope, to the countries that they're aiming for. There was the terrible case of a truck in Britain which had no ventilation, and a whole lot of, in that case, I think mainly Vietnamese people from Southeast Asia coming to Britain, attempting to come to Britain, died of suffocation. And here you have this terrible crash, and of course, almost every day in the Mediterranean and now in the so-called English Channel, or what the French call La Manche, the bit of sea, the very narrow piece of sea between France and Britain, people drowning there. That and the Mediterranean are in the highlight of attention now as Europe struggles in its very changed atmosphere towards immigration, changed considerably since 2015, when governments made a point then of being open to refugees, particularly in the wake of the massive population movements resulting from the Syrian civil war. But clearly the political climate has changed, and it's as if the authorities in both of those bodies of water are, if not turning a blind eye, are averting themselves from taking responsibility for safe passage of people who are, by their own choice, that is true, but nonetheless out of a kind of desperation, putting themselves at great, great risk in trying to get to the countries that they would like to be able to live in.
Let's go back to your adopted hometown of New York City, and we all know the Sackler family because of the Oxycontin crisis and their role in it. Well, the Metropolitan Museum of Art has announced that they will drop the name linked to that family, which actually I think has seven or eight different exhibition spaces at the Met. That name will no longer be put up anywhere in the Met.
Yeah, and there are many buildings and facilities and foundation grants for continuing work for artists right across the country and in Britain too. Mortimer Sackler in particular liked to have his name on artistic overarching an opportunity to enjoy art. You would often see the name of the Sacklers and Mortimer in particular, but it's a belated perhaps, but inevitable result of the family being in such disgrace now because of what's been revealed about what they did. But you know, one has to be realistic about the overall result of this sense of disgrace. It's there, but it has its limits. You remember that by hook or by crook, legal measures have ensured that the Sacklers themselves have limited the amount of financial damage they've had to suffer because of their proven responsibility in the opioid crisis and the explosion of addiction. If you've got well-paid lawyers, you can often survive such terrible attacks on your reputation, self-inflicted attacks they are, of course, but nonetheless, we're not going to find the Sacklers suffering terribly because as it is, perhaps the worst thing that could happen to them is that their names are taken off public places.
All right, and we'll come back to shootings in the latest school shooting. Two families so far have come forward and are suing the school district, the administrators, and some of the teachers because a lot of people knew or were aware of this student being unstable that did the shooting. I wonder, would it be better for parents to be charged themselves when they know in advance, of their child's propensity, especially when they've met with teachers, rather than taking it upon the school system?
Well, there's a lot of outrage in the press about this case, understandably. It's hard to say. One of the arguments being used in the press about the lack of the sort of all questioning, at least the wisdom of having other parents at the school do the suing of the school district for responsibility in this case, when clearly there has been such a lot of parental responsibility going amiss anyway, that much is clear. Whether it amounts to criminal negligence or indeed manslaughter, which is one of the charges in play here against the parents, one of the points being made is that it splits up, it fractures the unity of people in the community in response to the shooting. I'm not sure of the value of that argument, but what is clear is that as long as we do have the gun laws, the lax gun laws in this country that we do have, we're going to every now and again have a case where someone who's underage ends up with a gun and is able to to do what this young man allegedly was able to do. It's pretty clear that there was a trail here, that there were red flags before the event, and the critical thing, I guess, is the time frame. There was an opportunity, several opportunities for intervention, which were not taken, not extended, not taken, not put into action. It's desperately sad, and it's horrifically irresponsible on adults part, on the part of adults dealing with a clearly troubled underage person. But whether a legal case against the school district is warranted can only be worked out, I think, in a legal forum. So we'll have to see how that goes.
And I guess we'll wrap up. Bring up the death of Bob Dole, one of the one of the most recognizable big names coming out of the United States Congress and the Senate. His death and his funeral coming up. I do believe it's either today or tomorrow.
Sure, and he's getting, of course, the requisite bit of memorializing and honoring by lying in state in the Capitol building. I think for me, it marks another step along the way of the, a generation passing. I think he's now probably the last of political leaders in the United States who served in World War II. I mean, he's died now in his 90s. So I think we're now at the final falling off after the cresting of a wave of that form of leadership who had that kind of experience. We've had some examples, like I can think of John Kerry now, who is connected in many people's minds with the Vietnam War, where he served and in fact protested against the war as someone who had participated in it. But essentially, a large body of our leadership in the latter part of the 20th century and the first two decades of the 21st are older men, and mostly men in their case, of course, who served in World War II. And I think Bob Dole marks the passing away of that generation.
David, always great to speak to you, and enjoy the views that you're getting in Florida. And you down there for another week, or will you be back next week?
My plans are not very clear, but I think by next week I might well have forsaken the animal life down here and be back in New York City, yes.
All right, well, we'll speak to you then, and have a good weekend, David.
Look forward to that. Bye now.
David Terachuk with The Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. Once again, David's website, themediabeat.us.